What it's like to be on retreat. A very important part of our insight meditation tradition is this thing of retreats. And they're going to talk about, you know, especially for people who've never been on retreat, but even for people who have a little bit, to hear what happens on a retreat and the format, the experience of retreats, the interview process on retreats, and it all. So today what I want to talk about is a very traditional discussion about the preparation necessary for going on retreat. Now, I want to tell a story. And the story is comes from the time of the Buddha. And there, the Buddha was off living someplace in the woods, in the forest. He often lived out in the woods, wandering around India. And he had an attendant with him, a young new monk by the name of Meghiya. And Meghiya was the Buddha's attendant. So he helped. I don't know how old the Buddha was at this point. He lived until he was 80, 81. But he was responsible probably for bringing the Buddha his food and taking care of his various needs that a junior monk sometimes does for a senior monk. And so one day Meghiya went out for alms food, which is a custom of the monks, is to go out for alms, and he received some food, and he sat by the edge of a river and ate his food. And then it said he went walking up and down on the side of the river, exercising his legs after having the meal. Imagine, maybe so he wouldn't be sleepy for his meditation, he did some walking first. Since he only had one meal a day, it's probably a big meal, he wants to exercise a little bit before sitting down. And as he was walking back and forth up along the riverbank, he came across a grove of mango trees. That he looked at that grove, and this is a perfect grove for meditating. It's really serene and peaceful, and just all the conditions seemed just right for me to go off and sit on retreat by myself. So he went back to the Buddha and asked the Buddha for permission to go on a retreat. Now, going on retreat is a very important part of the Buddhist tradition. It's kind of like, you know, maybe the equivalent of 40 days in the desert, 40 days and 40 nights, or going off on a vision quest into the wilderness. To go spend some time, we step out of our normal currents of our life, out of the normal activities we do, the normal associations we have, and also the normal preoccupations of our mind. And to be able to let those things settle away out of our kind of surface consciousness, to let that which is deeper to begin show itself, and also to allow the concentration to develop in a very strong way when we're not kind of discombobulated from all the different input of our regular life. And so many traditions have it. The Buddhist tradition has it also. And Meghiya, being a young monk, probably had never done this before, was really eager to get on with this practice. And so he went to the Buddha and said, "May I go off and do a solitary retreat in this beautiful mango grove?" And the Buddha said, "No, please don't do that. This is not the time for that." So Meghiya, being perhaps maybe very enthusiastic or maybe stubborn or I don't know what, said, "Well, you know, you've already done what had to be done. You're already enlightened. And you've already done your spiritual work for yourself. And you have nothing left to do. You're just enjoying your enlightened state. And but me, I have a lot to do still. I'm far from enlightened. And I really need to get on with it." And so the Buddha said, "No, Meghiya, not right now. Let's wait until some other monks come who can attend to me. And this is not the time for you to do this." So Meghiya asked a third time if he could go off. And the rule is that if you ask a Buddha three times, the Buddha will acquiesce. I mean, within reason, right? But there's a lot of stories where Buddha, if he doesn't want to say something, like someone comes with a question, and the Buddha says, "I don't want to answer that now, later, please." But if a person asks three times, then the Buddha is obligated to give an answer to something. So Buddha said, "Sure, do as you wish." And so Meghiya went off on retreat, went out to the mango grove, and sat himself down with great spiritual sincerity and intention and faith and all that. And he sat down to meditate. And while he was meditating there, his mind was filled with lustful thoughts. and his mind was filled with hateful thoughts, and his mind was filled with confusion. So these are some of the options that occasionally happens to a few people on retreat. the mind has these things come to them. Sexual fantasies, great vendettas, irritations. And another common experience on retreat is when these kinds of things visit people, is especially among Westerners, they often get despairing or upset or angry or annoyed. And you know, sometimes self-deprecating. Oh, I'm so terrible as a meditator. Oh, terrible person I am. I have lustful thoughts, and this is bad. And I just can't admit this to anyone, let alone myself. And I better do something. You know, and it can often kind of like, you know, Westerners sometimes when they go on retreat, it's kind of like they think Buddhism is like a, you know, ascetic practice. You're supposed to flail yourself, and not that we ever say that to them. We tell them the opposite, but occasionally you have these people who are so quickly self-critical. And a very important part of the retreat process for such people is to coming to terms with that very strong disposition or tendency to be self-critical in unhelpful ways, and to find maybe rather a very different attitude, one of love or kindness towards oneself and the world. And for some people, that's a very important development that comes through the practice. So but in the Magia situation, what he said was he noticed these thoughts would come and assailed him, and he couldn't get concentrated. And so he said to the Buddha. So he said to himself, "This is amazing. This is awesome." In one English translation, that's how they translated it. It's awesome. And it's remarkable. Another translation. And the flavor of the way it's translated into English, I don't know the Pali, was kind of like he was just amazed. Wow, look at this. I have all sincerity and dedication. I found just the right grove to be on retreat in. And I was, you know, completely set on this practice. And I sit down and I have these bizarre thoughts that have nothing to do with my spiritual life. Isn't this amazing? The mind works this way. Wow. I wish more people had that kind of amazement when they come on retreat. Wow, isn't that something? It's like, you have this tremendous spiritual intention to sit down and do your morning meditation. And you do maybe a little spiritual reading first, and you really check in with your intention. You sit down with great resolve, and you do maybe have a little ritual to get you into the mood, and you sit down, you're finally settled and there, and you're really going to get into your meditation practice. And you start thinking about what you're going to have for dinner. You know, and this and that, and this and that. And, you know, somehow the juxtaposition between your great spiritual intention and the mind insisting on thinking about dinner seems amazing. How can this happen? How can such a superficial thing like dinner, you know, supersede my intention to really develop my concentration and presence? So he was amazed. So when he was amazed, he went to the Buddha, went back to the Buddha and said, "It's amazing. I went on a retreat and this thing happened. I was visited by lustful thoughts and by thoughts of ill will, revenge or anger or irritation, and thoughts of confusion and doubt." So the Buddha said, "Yeah, it is amazing." He didn't say, "You know, I told you so." But he said, "Let me tell you something. There are five conditions that support a person going on retreat and having a good experience. Five conditions that are good to have kind of under your belt, to have as a foundation for ongoing spiritual practice." So the Buddha said, the first thing is, it's really helpful to have good spiritual friends. In one translation they call it admirable friends. But to have people around you, both maybe teachers but also peers, people around you who you admire, who you look to as kind of companions in a good life, virtuous life, a spiritual life. People for whom they can reflect the good qualities you want to develop in yourself. People who can inspire you with a possibility of practice, because of their practice is quite inspiring. People for whom that can be mirrors for yourself, so that, you know, maybe their goodness or their wisdom or their understanding help you see yourself in a deeper and more realistic way. All things that were very important for me in my life. I don't think I could have done my spiritual practice without having a lot of spiritual friends around me. And people for whom I was inspired by. I saw their dedication, their practice. Remember one person at some point, just came to mind right now. I guess he was here yesterday, Les K. I hope it went well. But when I was living at Green Gulch Zen Center many years ago, I invited Les K to come up and give a Dharma talk there. And he gave a wonderful Dharma talk. But the thing that inspired me the most about Les was, at that point he'd been practicing for, I think, 20 years. And I felt like I could feel in his body, in his being, this 20 years of spiritual intention, of practice. And I was inspired by that sense of those 20 years of practice. Now it's been 35 years, so even more so. But I was inspired by the people around me who were practicing and involved and dedicated. And I was inspired by the qualities I saw in them. Another little story that just coming to my mind. I was working at this late 70s at anybody even know the Tassajara Bakery? So I worked at the Tassajara Bakery when I was more or less a new Zen student. And I was kind of fresh out of college. And I was up in the little office upstairs and with the bakery manager one day, and he opened the mail. And there was a letter from some little neighborhood association or something, maybe like a neighborhood association, asking for a donation for some good cause in the neighborhood. And he showed it to me. And I read it. I handed it back to him. And he immediately took out his checkbook and wrote a check for $50. A checkbook for the bakery money, and sent it off. And I was kind of amazed by this. Why would anybody do that? Why would anybody send a donation? Why would they want to support anything like that in the neighborhood? So this is a little bit embarrassing for me to admit that that's what I thought, but it hadn't occurred to me that, you know, we'd be good civic-minded people and help in that kind of way. But I was kind of just amazed by his act of generosity. And it was one of the little kind of very small thing, but it was just a little kind of a turning point for me to begin appreciating the value and power of generosity. And I started questioning, why did he do that? So here was someone who did something, a good spiritual friend around me, that had a big impact on me and set in motion a change. And then a lot of my spiritual friendships around me, both friends, the people I practiced with, and also my teachers, reflected back to me my own understanding. I was able to talk to them about my understanding and hear their understanding, give and take kind of thing. Sometimes my behavior was not always exemplary. And so sometimes it was very helpful to have someone say, hey, you know, by the way, Gil, what you just said or what you just did wasn't really, in your best interest and other people's best interest. Sometimes they were a little more direct about it. But it was very helpful to get that kind of feedback. And when a spiritual life is done in isolation without that kind of feedback, it's very dangerous, especially if a person is very intensely involved in the practice, because a person can go down all kinds of dead ends and dangerous routes in their practice that they can get into a lot of trouble. So having good spiritual friends around, is very helpful as a condition. Oh, this is something. My impression is that for people like in monasteries who are living in monastic settings, and there's a lot of peers, other monks and nuns, other practitioners practicing together. And I think probably, I hope it's the same thing here, that whatever wisdom that comes from the teacher and whatever people learn from the teacher is really insignificant compared to what people learn from each other. That somehow, people, everybody's kind of engaged and practicing and reflecting and thinking. And people get together, kind of peers in the practice, and talk about what they've learned. You hear what that teacher said, hear that teacher said, hear what, this is what my experience is. And we learn a lot from each other. And I think that's a very, very important avenue for learning in the spiritual life. And it's very helpful as a foundation to have that. So the first condition is having good spiritual friends. The second is to live a virtuous life, to live a life that's ethical. And it's a basic tenet, axiom, basic kind of truth in Buddhist spirituality, that if you really want to develop your spiritual life to any important degree, it's important to be an ethical person, to be a virtuous person. It doesn't mean that you necessarily have to have always virtuous thoughts. We're very understanding that people's minds have a mind of their own and do all kinds of unusual things, awesome things. But one of the things, the human psyche, who we are, we always have the veto power. Next week we have a guest speaker. Angie Boisevain is coming. And the following week, Tanisara Bhikkhu is going to come and speak. Tanisara Bhikkhu describes the mind as being it's like a board meeting of a corporation. And you're the chair of the board, and all these board members have a lot of things they can say, and they want a lot of things, they vote all kinds of ways, and sometimes it's outrageous what the board members want. Like in Hewlett-Packard, it seems like it's, you know. But on your particular board that you're serving, you're the chair of, you have veto power. And so it doesn't really matter what, you know, you're not in control of what all the board members say, but you have the veto power of what the corporation decides. So in the same way, you're not in charge of all the voices inside of you, what comes up, but you have a responsibility at least to have the veto power. Say, okay, that I'm not going to do. When you decide that you want to kill your neighbor, that thought comes up because the dog barks too much. You have the veto power. Say, well, that's not a good idea. I'm not going to do that. So to live an ethical life involves, in part, having some ability of restraint, some ability to be mindful of what one's tendencies are, and then hold back and say, this is not useful to do. And one of the reasons we practice mindfulness is to have that ability of restraint, to hold back from doing things which are unethical. Part of the reason why ethics is so important is that in Buddhist spirituality and mindfulness, we're trying to develop sensitivity. Mindfulness is another word for sensitivity. And if you want to be a sensitive kind of person, you can't do insensitive things. The two just don't work together. And the argument is that to kill, steal, lie, involve sexual misconduct, and to be involved in intoxicating our mind and body, in order to do that, we have to be insensitive to do it. And they cultivate greater insensitivity in us when we do. So one of the reasons for developing ethical foundation in Buddhism is not because of some moral judgment that you're a good or bad person, but rather you're setting the conditions for developing the deeper mindfulness concentration. And if the mind is agitated because of being unethical, then it's very hard to develop the concentration. The third condition is this is kind of unusual, I thought, a little bit. The wording of it is to have easy access to Dharma talks. I think it's kind of easy access to Dharma talks. Well, you know, we have pretty easy access here in Bay Area. There's all these Dharma talks happening all the time in the Bay Area. If you just wanted, you probably just kind of just cruise the Bay Area and, you know, every evening of the week and you could have Dharma talks, probably different Dharma talk from a different teacher every day of the year for a whole year. So many different teachers here and talks. People look towards the Bay Area and they live someplace like in the Midwest and they salivate because, you know, wow, you know, I have to drive 400 miles to the closest Dharma teacher in the Bay Area. It's like a dime a dozen. But easy access to Dharma talks. But the discourse gives a list of the kind of and this is an interesting list of the kind of talks you should listen to, the kind of Dharma talks you should listen to. And it's interesting because this is what the Buddha talked about a lot. Since the Buddha put high value on these kinds of talks, maybe this is what the Buddha talked about a lot. So I know I don't talk about this a lot, but maybe I should. But you can do this as you wish. But I thought it was interesting, the list. The way it's said here, furthermore, the person gets to hear at will, easily and without difficulty, talk that is truly sobering and conducive to the opening of awareness. That is, talk on having few wants, having few wishes, on contentment, on solitude, a non-entanglement, an arousing effort on virtue, on concentration, on discernment or wisdom, on release, and on the knowledge of vision and release. So a talk on having you should have easy access to talks on having few wishes. That's not a very popular thing, you know, to have few wishes in America. And we're supposed to have a lot of wishes because then we're good consumers. talks on being content is also. I mean, that's not a very high priority for Americans, to be content. And you know, if there's a big kind of advertisement in the paper saying, you know, this major world figure is going to come and give a talk on contentment. If it was emptiness or wisdom or enlightenment, people would go. But contentment? I was told, I gave a talk on contentment once here, and someone afterwards came up and said, this is a message which is not going to go over very well in corporate America, because corporations don't want contented workers. They want people who are ambitious, out to get more, and competitive. And the idea being, if you're content, you're not going to be competitive and kind of pushing to really, go as far as you can with the company. I don't know if that's true, but the Buddha put a lot of value on contentment, the value of contentment. So talks on contentment to help cultivate a sense of contentment in our life. Few wishes. So we're not agitated, the mind's not spinning out, looking and looking and looking for other things and being miserable because the mind's not happy with what's already here. And then on solitude. Solitude is the word viveka is a very important word in the Buddhist tradition. I think maybe in a few weeks I'll give a talk on it. It's very difficult to translate. Sometimes seclusion, sometimes solitude, sometimes detachment. It's the ability to let the mind turn away or separate itself from all its obsessive mental preoccupations. And many of us find out if we sit down to meditate, it's very hard to do that. That's a tremendously valuable thing, to be able to turn the mind away from all its preoccupations. And this kind of solitude, or seclusion away from all those preoccupations, so we can get down to the root of who we actually are, rather than kind of the surface chatter of the mind. A non-entanglement, on effort, on virtue, and concentration. So I like this little passage for various reasons, but we don't have to. It doesn't have to be talk. In the ancient world, they didn't have books, but nowadays it can be to read occasionally, to have access to books that inspire us a little bit, and help us along the way. Or now we can actually, get Dharma tapes. You know, Dharma Seed tape libraries. A whole culture of people who listen to Dharma talks in their cars, put the tape in. Or now we have Glenn, who has this wonderful website, where all the talks given here are put in the website. And I hear people all over the country now listen to the website, and people in Mongolia are listening to our Dharma talks here. So, and I think I told you that I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but there was a period of my practice for a few years where I read Dharma books almost every day, but I only read a page a day. And I found it very valuable to read a page, just to have some kind of inspiration, some kind of food for thought, some kind of a little focus for my reflection, helping me understand my life and be encouraged as I went along. Then the fourth condition is to abandon unwholesome mental qualities or mental states or activities, and take on or engage in wholesome mental qualities, develop wholesome mental qualities. This is a very classic Buddhist practice in Buddhist spirituality, is to have some sense of the mental quality of your mind, and then to kind of move back and forth, or look at it, and begin cultivating it like you're cultivating a garden. So if you have a lot of anger or hatred in your mind, to see what you can do to abandon that. to look at the value of love and generosity and see what you can do to develop those qualities. Not in a kind of a Pollyannish way, but in a way that I think, you know, is sincere and really allows for some deep shift in the valence or in the center of gravity where our mind is. So I know for myself, for example, that if I do certain activities, that they actually tend to predispose my mind to be agitated and to be more unwholesome in the future. If I look at certain movies, for example, if I see certain movies, certain kinds of movies, like very violent movies, I'll have, for a while afterwards, I'll have more easily have tendencies towards violence thoughts. You know, when I was quite a bit younger, sometimes I would look at pornography. And I noticed that the effect of pornography in my mind was that then I have these very unsavory kind of lustful kind of thoughts that kind of in the wake, momentum was set in motion by that kind of activity. If you're involved with greed, you know, always wanting money, and you're constantly involved in the stock market, that's all you think about day and night, then it predisposes the mind to the unwholesome development of greed, and that's the tendency it takes. If you're around certain friends who are always, when I was in my 20s, I remember I chose not to be around certain friends. It was very sad for me to do this, but I found that when I was with those friends, they were always very angry and swearing and criticizing and kind of bigoted. And it had an effect on me. I didn't become as bigoted as they were, but I could feel that my tendency to swear and do things was affected by being around them. So, what does it take to shift a little bit, take some responsibility, so that for our mental state, so that we do those activities that cultivate more wholesome mental states and avoid the more unwholesome ones? That level of responsibility is considered very important in Buddhist spirituality. And there's levels and degrees in which a person can do this, from choosing the activities we do to also choosing the thoughts that we follow. When I was growing up, I didn't realize that I could choose which thoughts I follow. But as I've been doing my practice, I feel I have a lot of choice now about, oh, there's a thought, that's an interesting, isn't that remarkable? Wow, awesome. Not now. No, thank you. I don't have to be involved in that. I have better things to do with my time than think about that. And our mind is really a precious resource. How do you use it? And to be just simply let your mind and thoughts kind of barrel along whatever way they want to go is to live a kind of, I think probably a little bit of a shallow life. But be able to, in a very healthy way, choose the avenues in which our mind takes, the thoughts that it takes, is beginning to take responsibility at the more subtle level of just what our activities are. And can we choose that which is conducive to wholesomeness rather than unwholesomeness? The danger in choosing wholesome over unwholesome is that sometimes it becomes a form of positive thinking, where you kind of just overlay kind of positive thoughts or idealism on top of what's really going on in us. And that's why it's very important to have something like a meditation practice, a mindfulness practice, that helps us to get underneath to what's really going on for us, so that we're not just simply overlaying good thoughts on top of some deeper motivations and feelings. So then, the fifth one, the last one, is, and this has to do, I think, mostly do with meditation practice, but here, I'll read it to you. Furthermore, that person is discerning or wise or mindful, endowed with the discernment of arising and passing away, noble, penetrating, leading to the right ending of suffering. The arising and passing away. The ability to perceive impermanence is considered to be one of the goals of meditation practice. And in fact, sometimes in Asia, Vipassana teachers will direct the students at some point when their meditation is quite concentrated to begin noticing that which is impermanent in their experience. In the tradition that I practiced in, they never suggested what you should look for. Rather, they just told you, keeping mindful, and whatever you need to know will be revealed by itself. But one of the hallmarks of getting into really deep Vipassana states is beginning to get a very intimate, moment-to-moment sense of how things, how our experience is arising and passing moment by moment. And this ability to see how mind states and thoughts and feelings and perceptions arise moment by moment, that they're not locked in the way that they are if we just relate to concepts. Concepts of the world tend to be fairly fixed. But if we can drop below the conceptual level of reality and see the arising and passing of phenomena, this is one of the most useful ways of beginning to help the mind be willing to let go of its clinging to concepts. And mostly that's all we cling to anyway. So to be able to see impermanence is one of the important foundations for deep spiritual work, or at least to appreciate the value of it. One of the reasons why, in Asia at least, impermanence is very highly valued, and there's a lot of Dharma talks on impermanence, is the emphasis is you don't have a lot of time. Life is really short and precious, and you better get on with it. If you really want to do your spiritual practice, get on with it. Even the Zen tradition, which tends to, like the Soto Zen tradition, has a very strong emphasis on this very moment is awakening or enlightenment or perfect just the way it is. And practice is realizing the perfection of the present moment. They'll also say, but get on with it. The present moment is perfect, but just you know, get on with it. And they have this image. Practice as if your hair is on fire. That's serious. You should be that serious. As if, you know, I don't know, you'd probably be pretty agitated if your hair is on fire. But the image is one of, you know, just get on with it. So, so these are the five conditions that, if you'd like, you can look at as the foundation of good spiritual practice, or at least a foundation for going on retreats, as Magia was going to go on retreat. This little story is in a collection of discourses of the Buddha called the Udana, which is called it translates into English as the Inspired Utterances. It's not known that the Buddha was a poet, and he composed a lot of poetry, and some of it was considered inspired poetry, just kind of inspired at the moment, just kind of inspired utterances. And this whole story is the background for the Buddha's inspired poem after giving this little talk to Magia. And I don't know if this English translation does justice to the Pali, but it goes like this. Subtle thoughts and trivial thoughts, when followed, stir up the heart. Not comprehending the thoughts of the heart, one runs here and there, the mind out of control. But comprehending the thoughts of the heart, one who is ardent, mindful, restrains them. When followed, they stir up the heart. One who is awakened lets them go without trace. So Magia was visited by lustful thoughts, hateful thoughts, and thoughts of confusion. And one who is awakened lets them go without trace. Is not influenced by them, or affected by them, or agitated by them. Just lets them self-liberate. The self-liberating function of thoughts. May all your thoughts be self-liberated and no longer bother you. So what are your thoughts in reply to all that? Yes, Jane?
And it's just so repetitive, and you think, oh, this is impermanent, but it seems, it's almost as though that's the permanent thing. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, it's like I don't understand, you know, there are these snaggles, and they don't unravel. Meditation, even though you're trying, you have intention, good intentions and everything, you can't unravel them. I mean, they just kind of come up again.
What you're saying, you're presupposing then that a person is a good meditator, knows how to bring mindfulness really to bear in a useful way on these things. But not everybody knows that. Not everyone knows how to investigate and explore resentment or anger as they arise and the causes and conditions for it. And that's a whole thing to learn. Some people don't avail themselves of good spiritual friends. And having a spiritual friends who can call you on these things or to help you reflect them is very helpful. And one of the really good spiritual friends, one of the good friends that a lot of people in America pay for is a therapist. And if there's a really repetitive pattern and you feel like your spiritual practice has engaged with it for a long time, it doesn't seem to help, then therapy is definitely should be considered. And 99% of good therapy is finding the right therapist.
In other words, there are certain things that meditation can't deal with. They're so entrenched that you need someone that's, like a trained person. Or is it possible to deal with this kind of thing in meditation? Or do you need,
It's a very good question. I'm sure a lot of people are interested in that, in the answer at least. what I can only do is to tell you, I don't have, empirical evidence to know what to say here, but I can tell you that there's different points of view in the American Buddhist tradition about this. There are some Buddhists who insist that they can only, that they can do it by themselves, through practice. And I've known people who have had, very serious problems, and they've gone off into, one guy went off to Tibet to be on, long retreat and said, I'm not going to do therapy, I'm going to do this on my own, through the practice. And some people who say, like Jack Kornfield, who say, you can't expect meditation to do it all. And that even people who get to the first stage of awakening, they really have very deep transformative experience in meditation, are still sometimes left with some of the neurotic patterning. And sometimes you need to combine it with therapy. So Jack Kornfield is a great exponent of kind of a balanced approach of therapy and meditation. And that he says, for example, that when he was teaching the three-month retreat at IMS, three-month intensive silent retreat, he said something like, half of the people there, at least, were not really ready even to meditate. They were it was kind of like a form of a therapy for them to be there. And the teachers had to then to accommodate that and meet that kind of concern. But the question is, can meditation be transformative? Depends a lot on how deeply a person goes into the meditative path. And if a person, for example, has a regular daily sitting practice and maybe once a year goes on a retreat, that might be very significant, very transformative for them, but it might not really be enough to let meditation do all that it can for you. And it might mean that you have to go, basically, for some people, let meditation do all it can do for you. Maybe it requires maybe a year or two of very intensive engagement, maybe letting go of work and going living in a monastery for a while and just really kind of being full-time engaged in this path to really let it go down into the very roots of where resentment and anger are born. So to say that meditation is not enough, might imply, well, these people aren't really taking the path as seriously as they can. But for most lay people who have jobs and family and all these things and can't do that kind of intensive practice, but can do some practice, daily practice and all that, and if they keep being plagued by certain things that reoccur, then probably one of the best routes to begin it, one of the routes to explore is therapy. But I think you've done that probably. So if you've done that to your, as thoroughly as you can, and then perhaps you find a Dharma teacher. I don't know if you ever talked to a teacher, Dharma teacher, specifically about how you've been engaged in your things, how you've taken your practice and engaged your practice in those particular issues. And it might be that, because you mentioned in your beginning that you talked about a lot of sesshins. Sesshin is a Zen practice, and Zen practice is a very powerful practice, which I love. But one of the weak links of the Zen tradition is they tend to have very little psychological understanding. And so if a person has anger, for example, mostly will tell you, just let go of it and follow your breath. And that's very powerful for some people, but it doesn't really help them sometimes get into the roots of their anger, which sometimes they need to do.
How is Vipassana different than let go of your anger?
don't let go of it. Bring your attention to it, and learn how to hold it in your attention, and explore it, and then begin exploring it. Maybe begin understanding various things about it. One of the things you might understand is that how to develop the skills that when anger arises, there's no hooks for it in your mind, so that anger can arise, but you don't do anything with it. Wow, that's amazing, awesome, anger. And you know, it's, and you continue with your life without, you know, buying into it. That's very, very powerful, and that's one of the things mindfulness is trying to cultivate, is that ability of having non-reactive awareness to what's happening, so that we have another option besides being swept away by something like anger. The other option is to leave it alone and then choose wisely what to do. The other thing is, but then is once we have that ability, then to really look at the anger much more carefully and deeply. And sometimes you can begin seeing the roots for it, what triggers it. Sometimes it's a matter of developing enough mindfulness, a strength of mindfulness, that you have a strong level of mindfulness in daily life. So you can begin taking responsibility in daily life for noticing what triggers it to begin with. Because some people actually don't catch it until many, many generations away. Another thing to do is to do loving-kindness meditation practice. Buddhism offers the antidote to certain things. There's a whole bunch of anecdotal practices in Buddhism. And I don't teach them very often, but the tradition, you know, puts emphasis on them. And in fact, this passage here, that I didn't read, talks about that. If you're plagued by lust, then the Buddha recommends that you meditate on here the word in Pali is asobha. Here they translate it as unattractive. Sometimes it's translated as the foul, the repulsive. I've translated it as the unpleasant, the unbeautiful. Soba is beautiful. But what it specifically means is you meditate on the body, for example, your body or the persons who you're lustful for, and you visualize, you imagine their digestive tract and their renal cavity and their mucous membranes and things which generally don't produce a lot of uplifting feelings. And that helps, comes, you know, as an antidote. If you really need an antidote for lust, then you kind of can do that, and that's helpful. The antidote for ill will is loving kindness. And some people, one of the reasons why some people are triggered to anger, aversion, ill will, irritation, judgment, kind of negative, angry judgment of others, is sometimes because they lack a sense of self-love or self-compassion or sense of being settled on themselves. And sometimes developing loving kindness is a way of having loving kindness towards oneself fills that place within us that's empty or wounded. And once that begins to be filled with some kindness and friendship, then the tendency to be that reactive settles down for some people. I can't imagine anyone here needs to know the antidote for distractive thinking. Does that interest anyone here? No? The antidote for distractive thinking is mindfulness of breathing. Just stay concentrating on the breath. Just forget the thoughts. Just stay with the breath. Kind of the Zen approach. Just be with the breath. And the antidote for conceit is seeing impermanence. Seeing impermanence. I think that usually they say concentration is good for the concentration, like on the breath, for example, for confusion.
Is confusion the same as doubt?
No, there's different words for them. I don't really know the difference, so technically, but the best of my understanding of the tradition is that confusion is simply not understanding kind of what's really there, kind of having illusion, delusion about what's really happening. So if someone, you're not really sure what's happening. Doubt is much more unsure what to do, unsure what the truth is, having doubts about it. Is this the right practice? Is this the right teaching? Is this, you know, is this the right time? Doubt about oneself, lack of confidence. I think it's a little bit different quality sense. Stephen, do you have a better distinction? Did you want to say something?
Oh, I was just actually thinking about what you were saying and how the fourth utterance does relate to metta in my experience. And yet, what you were saying about that is the abandonment of mental states. I was thinking the answer for me is to know whether I'm trying to cover up my negative thoughts or negative or ill thinking with metta, or whether it's the wholesome thing to do. And it's just sort of a personal call.
Great. That's a very good. So what Jennifer is pointing to is this very important issue in mindfulness practice. We're always interested in the intention behind the choices we make. So if a choice is to take on an antidote practice, like loving kindness for ill will, is for what reason? What's the motivation for it? And if the motivation is aversion to your ill will, that may be not so useful. But if it's out of wisdom, then it's useful to do. So what's the motivation for why you're doing this particular practice you're doing is very, very, very important to ask regularly. So like the approach of, I'm going to be really accepting of the present moment so that shoulder pain goes away. God, that shoulder pain. Really accepting, so it's kind of counterproductive. So I hope that this talk gives you the idea that spiritual life and Buddhist spiritual life can be thought of as building on a foundation, and getting a good foundation in place is a very important part of the process. And you might have your own ideas of what that foundation should be for you, but this list of five is one list of five foundation pieces. So, thank you for listening.